used to wish that the story I'm about to tell you was different. That it involved different bands, different venues, different friends. I used to want to tell you that when I was 14 years old, someone's older brother played me Bikini Kill's Pussy Whipped in his car, or Circle Jerk's Group Sex on cassette. And this punk rock prophet, older, cooler, reeking of clove cigarettes, took me on a musical journey that climaxed with me falling in love with the mosh pit at a Descendants or, hell, even a NoFX show, certifying my status as a card-carrying, spiked-hair, cop-hating, anarcho-punk. Well, my story is not that story. My story starts in Miss Darrow's English class in Westlake High School in 2001. Music was becoming a currency, especially lucrative to those of us who had neither good looks nor athletic ability to cash in on. Punk, emo, and indie has always been a refuge for the chronically uncool, and I was eager to get my passport stamped in this land I had only briefly heard about. One day in Miss Darrow's class, with decidedly little learning occurring, my friend Scott motioned me over and pressed play on his Discman. The weaving notes of an acoustic guitar poured out of his shitty headphones for exactly 8 seconds before Rivers Cuomo launched in with an electric guitar and the words, "My name is Jonas." I was in, and I never wanted to leave. Around that same time, my mom took me to that punk rock palace we all know as Best Buy. Well, back then they sold CDs, and evidently had some Hanukkah money to burn or something. I have an image of the sun streaming through the dirty sliding glass doors as I stood by the racks of records in that Best Buy off Southwest Parkway and the frontage road, holding in my hand Weezer's Pinkerton and Blink-182's Dude Ranch. Yes, the whole thing was corporate as fuck, but look, we all start somewhere, right? Here, I think Frank Turner said it best before he covered Blink's first hit, Damn It.
No motherfucker anywhere woke up one morning and started listening to Naked Radio. Do you know what I mean? We all had gateway bands. Rancid and one of mine are now one of my fucking favorite bands, and I adore them. But you know what? You know what? Props to the fucking Offspring and Green Day as well, because without them, I wouldn't know what punk is. And if you're too cool for that statement, then you're talking out of your fucking asshole. Seriously. But within that as well, somebody once kind of in the UK, some asshole on the internet. Once kind of said that at best I would be a gateway band for kids getting into punk, and I said to myself, that is a wonderful thing to fucking be. If all I ever achieve in my life is telling other kids who the fuck the Descendants are. So with all that in mind, this is a cover. A few years ago, I was playing a house show in a squat in Orange County, and it was the most hipster punk place I've ever been in my life. Beautiful people, I'm not slagging them off, they were fucking great, but they were very, very hipster punks. And I played a set, and halfway through I played this song, and every single person lost their shit, and it proved my fucking point. So let's see how we do with this. I'm so excited for the first line of this song. It's alright to tell me what you think about me, and I won't try to argue or hold it against you. And I know that you're leaving, and you must have your reasons, and the season has fallen, your pictures are falling.
After collecting bands like so many Pokemon, I was ready for my next rite of passage, my first concert. Given that Blink and Green Day were the hottest bands in the scene, it was almost mandated I go see them on the Pop Disaster Tour in 2002. Jimmy Eat World, a band whose new record, Bleed American, I loved, was opening. The show was in Selma, Texas, outside of San Antonio, a place I had only been accompanying my grandfather at the racing track there. My dad dropped us off. It was in a giant amphitheater, and I remember it all, the way the sun was going down, the sea of empty seats as Jimmy Eat World played, the deafening noise when Green Day took the stage. My friends were there exclusively for Green Day, and while I love them too, Blink held a special place in my heart. You never forget your first, right? We were way in the back against the railing, and as Blink played, sloppily, mind you, I bounced up and down against the rail, extending my hand towards the band, screaming the lyrics. My friends were honestly kind of freaked out by my visible volcano of emotion. In the car ride home, they said, "David, you should do more of that. You really seem to like it." I did. I react viscerally, physically, emotionally to music, especially in a live setting. And while I'm sure I look stupid, grasping at the air for dear life, burying my face into a stranger's shoulder, or pulling at my hair and t-shirt in what could look like agony, it is the only way I have ever known how to do it. From that very first show, I realized that from music, I received a rush that others would use to describe bungee jumping or religious conversions. That night, Blink played Carousel, their first song ever, and I learned what a deep cut was. I bought a t-shirt, and I learned what overpriced merch was. And as they banged through their closer, damn it, I saw where my future was, in the middle of the circle pit. It would be the last time my ticket was marked anything but general admission for a long time. We all have our gateway bands. Blink was one of mine. I'm David Callison, and this is The Sound and the Story. There's a contemporary idiom that puzzles and irritates me in equal measure, Jennifer Sisley wrote in The New Yorker. Guilty pleasure is it. I object to neither the pleasure nor the guilt. It's the modifying of one by the other that works my nerves, the awkward attempt to elevate as well as denigrate the object to which the phrase is typically assigned. That all being said, Blink-182 are a decisively guilty pleasure band. Their first three records plus a live disc combined bratty SoCal pop punk with simple lyrics and toilet humor to make songs that were absolutely perfect for teen sex comedies like American Pie, which they had a cameo in, along with a monkey, I think. And it's no accident. That's exactly the type of band Blink wanted to be. In 1992, 17-year-old Tom DeLonge got kicked out of his high school for showing up drunk to a basketball game. He was forced to attend a different high school. There, Tom befriended Carrie, who was dating Ann Hoppus, Mark's sister. Ann would be the one to introduce Mark and Tom. Unafraid of a new crowd, Tom signed up for his new school's Battle of the Bands and played a sure-to-be classic track, "Who's Gonna Shave Your Back Tonight?" Scott Rayner was in the crowd and asked Tom to jam. He would become Blink's first drummer. Eventually, the trio, Mark, Tom, and Scott, started hanging out together, writing songs, going to shows, and playing practical jokes. Eventually, they put out some bootleg demos and played relentlessly in and around San Diego, just as the SoCal skate punk sound, or pop punk, was reaching new heights. Blink would often play the smaller rooms of venues like Soma, while the bigger West Coast bands like Social Distortion, Green Day, The Offspring, and NoFX played upstairs in the main room. Around this time, Mark's boss at his record store job, Pat Secor, offered to pony up $1,000 for them to record a proper demo. It was called Buddha, based on a little statue of his father's that Mark grabbed on his way out of the house to the recording studio. It was also called Buddha because I think randomly, Hoppus's hand-drawn artwork on that first four-track demo had an A drawn on it. Each subsequent album would be in alphabetical order. B is Buddha, then Cheshire Cat for C, D is Dude Ranch, and E is Enema of the State, where they stopped. Or did they? The live album released next features an F as the logo of Travis's clothing company. The cover of Take Off Your Pants and Jacket features a G on the front sleeve. The untitled record, the slash that goes from left down to right, combines with the outer circle and forms an H. On the Greatest Hits record, you can still see the capitalized I behind the one in the band name. It looks like offset text. And on Neighborhoods, there's a J spray painted on one of the buildings. And finally, on California, their most recent record, the woman's closed right eye and eyebrow makes a K. This is what you come to sound in the story for, isn't it? So anyway, in late 1994, their demos and countless shows paid off, and they were signed by Cargo Records, the Deep Elm of SoCal Punk. Oh, do y'all remember Deep Elm and the Emo Diaries? Oh, the first two of those are so good. Okay, sorry. Blink signed to Cargo with only Mark signing the actual contract, as Tom was at work and Rayner was a minor at the time. But unfortunately for Blink, there already was a Blink. I'm sure you've heard of the Irish techno band that goes by Blink? No? Well, America's Blink had a week to change their name, and Undecided added a random number to the end, 182. And this was years before Millions did the same thing while creating their AOL screen name. Blink 182 churned out 16 tracks in 3 days of recording and released their debut record, Cheshire Cat, a collection of songs that the rough and the vocals department hold up as catchy if juvenile pop punk songs, like a somehow more nasally take on the Descendants.
This one guy, there's no one like him in all of the world, cause you can always see those girls down on their knees in those dark, sweaty rooms, planning out his thoughts. He's waiting for just the right one by one as they walk right through the door. They keep on coming back. I guess they just want more. Yes, fun, fun, fun. And you might call him a whore, but just look where he's at, cause he is the one that's scores.
Blink continued to tour and tour and get bigger and bigger. In 1996, Pennywise guitar Fletcher Dragg told Kevin Lyman to put Blink on the second edition of his Warped Tour. He did, and audiences and labels took notice. Blink found itself in the middle of a bidding war between Interscope, MCA, and Epitaph. Epitaph was a punk label in the middle of punk going mainstream. Bad Religion, the founding band of Epitaph, left its own label and signed with Atlantic in 1993. Is anything sacred anymore? Certainly not to Blink. Well, not to most of Blink. Mark and Tom were never precious about the punk scene, probably because they didn't subscribe to punk with a capital P, the straight-edge bands and their militant collectives, or singing songs about the government. They just wanted to have fun, man. Scott Rayner didn't see it that way and became disillusioned when the band signed to MCA over Epitaph. Their producer for the next record would describe Blink as the most business-centric band I'd ever seen at that point. They had their shit together. That producer, Mark Trombino, was picked for his work on the aggressively emo album Static Prevails from Jimmy Eat World. Blink was heavily influenced by, you guessed it, Jawbreaker, as well as Bad Religion, Lagwagon, and The Descendants. With big studio money, they had big studio time, about 5 weeks of recording, and it turns out they needed it, given everyone's physical state. Mark was a constant smoker, and it was catching up to him. He struggled through trying to record Damn It, which was accidentally written just out of his range. It got so bad that Hoppus canceled a week of recording in order to quit smoking, get his voice healed, and re-record vocals. DeLong, too, had vocal issues and spent a lot of time recording and re-recording vocals. Finally, Scott Rayner had gotten drunk at a party, jumped off a balcony, and broken both his heels. I know. He recorded his parts from a wheelchair. The album Dude Ranch was released, and it percolated slowly. Tom is quoted as saying, "The label fucking hated pop punk and didn't have a great strategy around it. I'm also not sure how they felt about the title being a euphemism for semen. But hey, what do I know?" But then Damn It finally found its way to rock radio around the country. At that point, Blink had made it to the big time. Tom said, "I remember right before Christmas 1997, we sold 40,000 copies in 1 week. That's when I went, oh my God, this is heavy. That and when I had a gold record and gave it to my dad. My dad was all about business and getting a career, go to school and everything. And he was not always as supportive about the band, never understood. Then when I gave him a gold record, he was kind of like emotional. He was all proud of me." Around this time, drummer Scott Rayner had some personal business to attend to back home, so their tour mates, the Aquabats' drummer, filled in. His name was Travis Barker. Since Rayner had left suddenly, Barker had very limited time to learn all the songs, but he was up to the challenge. Legend has it that he learned the entire 20-song set in 45 minutes. On stage, he crushed it. Rayner would come back, but his drinking and obstinance were causing problems for the band and the tour. Scott said he would go to rehab and get clean, but Mark and Tom had had enough. Later recounted in their song Man Overboard, they fired him, immediately hired Travis, and went back to the studio with Jerry Finn, the godfather of pop punk producing. Sports fans, this was the Drew Bledsoe, Tom Brady moment of punk rock. Over the next 3 years and 2 albums, Blink became a massive mainstream hit, selling 15 million copies of the scatologically titled Enema of the State and making music videos parodying boy bands and running around LA naked. They toured arenas, appeared in American Pie, and released Take Off Your Pants and Jacket, a not very hidden masturbation pun. Get it? Take off your pants and jacket. This one sold 14 million copies, helped by 2 radio singles that weren't recorded until the last minute. The label had wanted a more summertime anthem thing, and both Mark and Tom went and wrote, in about 10 minutes, the sunniest, poppiest, cheesiest rock songs they could imagine. And that's how Rock Show and First Date came to be. Overall, the band felt confined by the label's expectations and didn't feel like the album made any leaps forward in creativity. Which is one of the reasons Tom DeLonge holed up with Blink drummer Travis Barker and producer Jerry Finn and made, well, this? Was Boxcar Racer, and it was made by all of Blink except Mark Hoppus, and Mark Hoppus was not pleased. Travis also went and made a punk rap record with Tim Armstrong of Rancid. They were called The Transplants. Scattered with all these different projects, the band was in disarray. These tensions, musically and personally, would linger and later boil over, eventually causing a 4-year hiatus. But before that, they would record arguably their greatest record, a middle finger to anyone who is too cool to listen to their music after their mainstream success. Mark, Tom, Travis, and Jerry Finn went in the studio one last time and made the untitled. Marcus said the record is definitely untitled, not self-titled. And that's where we begin. Two songs of Blink's Untitled album are about sex, which is not uncharted territory for the band, but these two songs immediately illustrate Blink's new quote-unquote mature style. Basically, it feels like they spent more than 5 minutes on the lyrics. Feeling this was born when Mark and Tom went into separate rooms to write lyrics, and both coming out with songs about love and lust. Mark's about the wistful excitement of a new crush, and Tom's about the immediacy and passion of a first fuck. They combined the two songs into the track that was originally called Action. Taking Tom's lyrics as one, we have a frenzied, passionate night. Show me the way to bed. Show me the way you move. Fuck it, it's such a blur. I love all the things you do. Our breathing's got too loud. Show me the bedroom floor. Show me the bathroom mirror. We're taking this way too slow. Take me away from here. And then Mark's lyrics altogether paint a portrait of sweet springtime romance. It was over by August. Fate fell short this time. Your smile fades in the summer. Place your hands in mine. I'll leave when I wanna. This place was never the same again after you came and went. How could you say you meant anything different to anyone? Standing alone on the street with a cigarette on the first night we met. Look to the past and remember a smile. And maybe tonight I can breathe for a while. I'm not in this scene. I think I'm falling asleep. But then all it means is that I'll always be dreaming of you. Together, they create a pastiche of the different parts of a quick romance. It's something that feels new and welcomed in the Blink catalog. Instead of a writing about themselves but 10 years younger, story of a lonely guy about taking someone to prom, and the anti-parents screed Anthem Part 2 were written when the boys were nearly 30. Mark and Tom explored layered emotion and consequence, something lacking from their earlier work. Even another broken heart song like Obvious takes on new dimensions here. The chords are dark. Travis described it as Failure meets Zeppelin meets the Police. Failure was an industrial grunge band that was big in the early 90s. Tom sings, "And I saw you again and again and again. How do we fix this if we never had vision?" Tom keeps seeing this girl in his head, imagining her with different partners, different lovers, but asks rhetorically, how could they ever have fixed it, given that the relationship never had a plan, a vision? Obvious is about a quick relationship as well, but it's told from someone who willingly agreed to its casual nature and now laments its failing nonetheless. It's obvious, he says, and it is. They were never going to work out, and both of them knew it. This song is about one of those people reminding himself of that knowledge against the turmoil of a breakup. This turmoil is continued throughout the album. Instead of sugarcoating these boy meets girl moments as in First Day or Rock Show, or making jokes about them as in every other Blink song, this untitled album plays with scope and cinema. In Violence, Tom said he based the entire song of just one image, a beautiful girl walking into a room and everyone being completely, almost mystically enraptured with her. And the violence she commits is on their psyches, on their self-control. As Robin Williams' character said in Good Will Hunting, but you've never looked at a woman and been totally vulnerable, known someone that could level you with her eyes, feeling like God put an angel on earth just for you, who could rescue you from the depths of hell. Tom digs into the visceral, almost physical effects of attraction or fantasy, repeating, like violence, you kill me, which is, granted, a tautological line, a line that works less the more you think about it, but used here, it gets at the ferocity of his feelings. It also adds a menace to the song that feels like an old film noir, the femme fatale who ends up dying as a plot point in the main male character's journey. The finger snaps at the beginning, the slow dramatic bridge, it all adds to the cinematic effect that continues into the next two songs. Cat cattle the eyes that stare, cat cattle the things they see. She kills with no life to spare, just victims are left to bleed. One drink and the pain goes down, soft shadows lay by her feet. Lay soft as you slowly drown, lay still as you fall asleep. Like violence, you have me.
Since that last night we were together, and will hold that night especially in my memories for years to come. I've been turning it over and over in my mind lately. I've read your letter through at least 4 times, and will probably read it more times before I'm through. I've been sitting here, looking at your picture, and getting more homesick every minute. I've wanted that picture more than anything else I know of, except, of course, you yourself. I keep thinking of you, darling. I keep wishing I could be home with you. I want to leave in the worst possible way so I can come home to see you, but things don't look so good on that subject. But this war has spoiled a lot of things for everyone, I guess. never been so lonesome in my life as I am right now. I'm completely lost without you, darling. I never realized I could miss any one person so much. I just hope it won't be too much longer until I'm able to be with you again and live a sane and normal life.
Stockholm Syndrome starts with a deeply earnest spoken word reading of letters Merck's grandfather sent to his grandmother when he was deployed during World War II, all set against a deeply plaintive piano. I'm not gonna lie, I still think about this interlude. It's beautiful. Having an actress read this letter written by the grandfather adds to the surreal filmic quality the first half of the album carries out so well. The letter ends with, "I just hope it won't be too much longer time able to be with you again and live a sane and normal life." The irony we know now, of course, is that American life would never be normal or sane. And that's what Stockholm Syndrome is about, a deep paranoia about the futility of life. As you might guess, this is a Tom song, and I think it's worth it right here to very briefly give a quick history of Tom's view about life, both on Earth and elsewhere.
And what's even more interesting, the big defense contractor that does all the UFO stuff, like for the military and the government, is in La Jolla. And out in front of their building, they have 2 8-foot-tall Egyptian statues. And one is holding a pyramid in his hand, and it says the past. And one's holding a pyramid in his hand, and it says the future. And they're big bronze statues in front of this company. And this company, I have on one of these tapes, a girl testifying how they put billions of dollars or millions of dollars into UFO-related programs, and they create them, and they're fake. So when they get audited by the General Accounting Office of the United States government, it just looks like all the money's going into fucking more helicopters, but it's really going into, like, UFO-related programs. And there's Egyptians in front of the building, dude, holding pyramids and saying the past and the future. I have people from the government talking about aliens. They're fucking real, you son of a bitch.
The song Aliens Exist from Enema of the State was not a joke song, but a legit take on a man who believes in aliens, but no one believes him. In the song, he's directing his anger at the government, because the government knows there's something going on and hiding it. And that's not my interpretation. That was a direct quote from Tom about the song. He sings, "What if people knew that these were real? Leave my closet door open all night. I know the CIA would say, what you hear is all hearsay. Wish someone would tell me what was right." In Boxcar Racer, he explored these ideas further. On Watch the World, a sort of messianic apocalyptic love song, he sings, "I saw Virginia get rid of Langley and its secrets too. I held your hand and sat there knowing that we'd make it through." In the next verse, he continues saying, "I saw this man dispose of hunger and soap operas too. I saw this field that grew perfection full of things you do." CIA headquarters is located in Langley, Virginia, so one of his ideal wishes in this song would be that the CIA would be disbanded, along with its supposed secrets. He also imagines a utopian world where we can grow anything and dispose of hunger. So then, after Blink, came the deeply serious Angels and Airwaves, whose presentation, accompanying documentary, and music video short films continued the alien and conspiracy theme, as well as dreaming of a utopian world. "Do you know what it's like to believe?" Tom sings. "It makes me want to scream." Tom has also since started a website for alien and conspiracy theories called Strange Times, and is looking to make a film based on that. He wrote a children's book that was actually released about an astronaut alone on the moon on Christmas who gets visited by aliens. All of this continues to be real. In 2015, he founded the To the Stars Academy of Arts and Sciences, an organization for the study of UFOs and alien life. In 2018, it reported a $37 million deficit, leaving its future unknown. So, for basically the first time, except in the aforementioned Aliens Exist track, Tom brings some of that worldview to Blink, here, and Stockholm Syndrome, the title of which refers to a psychological condition where captives fall in love with their captors. This is the first thing I remember. Now it's the last thing left on my mind. Afraid of the dark, do you hear me whisper? An empty heart replaced with paranoia. Where do we go? Life's temporary. After we're gone, like New Year's resolutions. Oh, that's such a terrible line. Why is this hard? Do you recognize me? I know I'm wrong, but I can't help believing. This course is all about Tom's paranoid and conspiratorially minded beliefs. And notice he says, I know I'm wrong, but I can't help believing. Meanwhile, Mark offers the relationship side of the song. You're cold with disappointment while I'm drowning in the next room, the last contagious victim of this plague between us. It's a metaphor for the end of a relationship and the animosity, but also love and lust between the two parties, feeling toxic, like a plague. He continues, I'm sick with apprehension, I'm crippled from exhaustion, and I dread the moment when you finally come to kill me. All this turmoil from the relationship has made him anxious and tired, and he's waiting for her to just come in and end it rather than prolonging the misery. And so basically, Tom's lyrics here sound like a metaphor, but they're meant to be taken literally, where for Mark, it's vice versa. Rounding out the cinematic trio is Down, a song, again, based on one specific image, a boy and a girl in a car with the rain pouring down, the boy anxious to express how he feels, aka kiss her. Maybe you've had this moment, maybe you haven't. I have, very specifically. It kind of goes like this. So you've been seeing this person for a bit now, right? And no labels because, you know, can this kind of love even be given a label? What's the label for making out in the back half of the theater and splitting a pint of vegan ice cream in the park on a sticky summer night? You don't ask about other people because, you know, you just want to be here in this moment with this person, taking off these clothes, collapsing onto this bed. And then one night, just accidentally, you two go out to dinner. And even though you both came from work, you find yourself a little more dressed up than normal. And you drove, but they Ubered. And the dinner is over, and you're about to walk to the car, and it starts raining. Like, pouring down rain. And you run to the car, laughing, crying out, incredulous to the amount of water soaking into your clothes, but almost reverentially thankful that this moment is happening to both of you. It feels like seeing a shooting star. And you get in the car and catch your breath and look at each other and realize that this is one of those moments. The moment where the relationship will move forward, labeled as fuck. The moment where you realize that this is all you want. And also the moment when you look over and have no idea what the person sitting across from you is feeling. And the rain is coming down, down, down. And you start to feel so down, down, down. I'll try to kiss you if you let me. This can't be the end. Go and Easy Target have a darker edge musically, leaving the wandering atmospherics of side one behind for a stripped-down punk song. Mark's vocals on Go compressed into a tight spring bark out some of Blink's most personal lyrics to date. Mark tells the story here of his mother and him fleeing his abusive father's or stepfather's house. Are we all victims of opportunity? Locked outside the door back in 83, I heard the angry voice of the man inside and saw the look of fear in my mother's eyes. That first line is especially interesting. Mark and his mother here are definitely victims of opportunity as they live with their abuser, and he has plenty of opportunities to hurt them. But as we hear at the end of the song, this getaway attempt was a failure. Mark becomes a victim of his mother's feelings that she does not have the opportunity to escape. I'm sorry, Mark, there's nowhere to stay, she says, indicating that if the physical circumstances were different, perhaps they could leave. Different victims of different opportunities. He and his mom get to the car, and dual thoughts are running through Mark's head. Go, 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 just go. Let's go anywhere but here with this man. But also, I don't want to know. A plea to have the ignorance his age affords him, but that the real world and this man's violence toward his mother is taken away. And though he sympathizes with her, of course, he acknowledges she has to hide her broken heart and let the escape attempt come to an end, he is also angry at her. Can't you see that I am in a world of shit? Turn your back on hope and go back inside. Stop my bleeding heart and let the engine die. The chorus begs her to action. Can we please just go? The song Easy Target also feels like a portent of darkness told as a fairly innocuous story. Jerry Finn told the band that in middle school he had a massive crush on a popular classmate. Knowing this, she invited him over, only to drench him with a hose, making him ride his bike back soaking wet and humiliated. The girl's name was Holly, and the band used it both in this song and in the next, All of This. Holly's looking dry, looking for an easy target, is a direct reference to the water play of the incident. Mark seems to use the incident as an extrapolation of how painful humiliation can be, at whatever point in life. Better run, 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 Holly let me out, he implores at the end, implying a feeling of imprisonment, not literal, but to keep being attracted to those who only see him as an object of their amusement. In a way, the line, take a photograph as the last train is leaving, feels like this song, a picture of a defeat taken of a loner, an outsider, missing the train and left stuck on the platform in a city they don't want to be in. Mark also includes a nice tip of the hat to Influences Social Distortion, whose album Mommy's Little Monster is name-checked here. We should also shout out Travis's ferocious snares, by the way. We haven't talked about it much, but you should definitely appreciate the fact that one of the most talented drummers of his generation primarily played drums for a band who has three albums named with scatological and sexual references. He really is one of the greats, not just in punk, but in rock in general. Easy Target outs directly into All of This, featuring... Wait, what? Robert Smith of The Cure? Holy shit. Does Robert Smith know he's in a Blink-182 song? No, but evidently they got in touch, and he said yes, and they recorded the song in the States, and then sent it to England for Smith's vocals. Robert Smith even said this about the band... I think they suffer in a way that we, The Cure, suffered, and that people weren't allowing them to become something else. If another band put out that new CD, the untitled record, as their first album, people would go crazy. It's a beautiful song, and lyrically, directly and indirectly, pulls on Easy Target again, name-checking Holly, and now the protagonist is running back to her, asking her to use him up. It reminds me of the Offspring lyric, "Now I know I'm being used." That's okay, man, because I like the abuse. can't find anywhere if Smith wrote any of the lyrics. I don't think so. But regardless, it's some of the best writing on the record, with parallel line structure reflecting their protagonist's dual feelings for two people. With all of this I know now, everything inside of my head, it all just goes to show how nothing I know changes me at all. All and I know from the first line are repeated in the last line, and nothing and everything are contrasted in the second and fourth lines. Again, I wait for this to change instead, to tear the world in two, is a nice apocalyptic image shifted later as, again, I wait for this to pull apart, to break my time in two, and then still later as, oh, again, I wait for this to fill the hole, to shake the sky in two. And finally, the rejoinder, another night with her, but I'm always wanting you. And how much can we trust this narrator? If they really wanted to be with the person of their dreams, why do they stay with the person that they're with? Why is it continually another night with her? Why not run, 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 as Mark says in Easy Target? Or go, 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 as he says in Go. We go where we know, I guess. Fitting in nicely with all of this, a sister song of sorts, As I Miss You. Inspired by The Cure's The Love Cats, Tom wondered what an all-acoustic Blink might sound like. Mark plays an upright bass, and Travis drums with brushes instead of sticks. The lyrics are peppered with references to Travis and his then-wife's favorite flick, Nightmare Before Christmas. That's the Jack and Sally and Halloween on Christmas. And otherwise, the song deals with not only missing someone, but missing them against the darkness of our minds, the anxiety, the depression, and paranoia talked about elsewhere on the record. It also inspired the Chainsmokers, who played the song on repeat on tour, to write their smash hit, Closer. So, yeah. The last song I want to talk about in this record is an okay little song called Asthenia, which means a lack of energy, a loss of strength in the body. It's another Tom song, so naturally the intro is actual recordings from the Apollo 11 mission. It's about being in space, alone, about an astronaut looking down on Earth and thinking, should I go back, should I go back? And I feel alone and tired. What's interesting is that it perfectly mirrors Tom's future answers on why he quit Blink. He misses family. He was bored and wanted to expand his musical horizons. He felt exhausted. My head is made up of memories, most of them useless delusions. This room is bored of rehearsal and sick of the boundaries. I miss you so much. The untitled album came out and critics and fans praised the new, more mature Blink. Even meanie mags like Spin and The Village Voice, rest in peace, praised the record. And then after a year of touring across the world, Tom said he needed some time, at least half a year, to step back and be with his family. The rest of the band didn't love the idea and communication broke down. Tom officially quit via his manager. Yikes. While Mark and Travis were waiting for him in the studio. Double yikes. In February of 2005, the band announced an indefinite hiatus. Tom didn't talk to Mark or Travis for years after. Meanwhile, Mark and Travis almost immediately started up Plus 44, which was basically Blink, but kind of dancing and not as good. Tom started up Angels and Airwaves, which was more successful, but didn't live up to his proclamation that it would be, and this is a direct quote, the best music in generations. Nor need he worry when he said, before the album came out, I started having these panic attacks thinking about every country in the world wanting us there multiple times. Conquering the globe is a pretty large endeavor. If that sounds like something someone who is high would say, you are correct. Tom admitted later that he was addicted to painkillers during this time and, quote, almost died. Angels and Airwaves would put out more albums, short films, and weird space stuff in the following years. In 2008, a couple weeks apart, two tragedies brought the band back together. Their longtime collaborator and producer, Jerry Finn, the producer of this record, died unexpectedly at age 39. Then, Travis Barker, ironically carrying with him a lifelong phobia of air travel, was involved in a serious plane crash with his friend, DJ AM. Travis's and AM's assistants and the plane's pilots all died in the crash. Barker had 16 surgeries and severe PTSD. Doctors assured him he would need prescription painkillers for the rest of his life. Ever the punk, Barker said, fuck you to all that and quit all painkilling drugs, including marijuana. At points, he was in so much pain, he called friends asking them to end his life in exchange for $1 million. Unfortunately, DJ AM, also suffering, dove deep into the painkillers and overdosed and died just 3 months after the crash. Mark and Tom saw all of this from afar, and the band reunited at the 2009 Grammy Awards. This history is so long, I'm going to super summarize, but basically, the goodwill of reunification was tenuous at best. They recorded an album, Neighborhoods, but remotely, with all three recording their parts separately in separate cities. Over the next few years, they toured, and Tom quit the band, and then he joined the band again, and then he kept delaying getting started on new music, but the band had finally locked in some studio time. And then Tom's manager, again, emailed them and said Tom was out. Like, out, out. So Mark and Travis say that Tom quit the band and wasn't into the reunion at all. Tom says, I don't know, Tom says a lot of things, you can go look them up. But regardless, the reunion was done. Finally, fucking finally, Mark and Travis continued on and recruited Alkaline Trio guitarist Matt Skiba to fill in for a few shows. Well, just like with Travis some 20 years later, Skiba quickly became full-time and Blink continued touring and put out the album California in 2016. They are currently working on an album now, and Mark has brought up the untitled record as an inspiration, saying, we'll keep the core of Blink 182, but we'll get a little more experimental, kind of like what we did on the untitled record, which we're all really proud of. It still sounded like Blink and had that Blink feeling, but it was different and a little more thought out. Blink 182, ever evolving. So maybe I didn't say it enough, but I love this record. I love Blink 182, I'm not gonna lie. I don't listen to all their stuff anymore, but there's some songs that I completely dig. I think Damn It is still a jam, and I think Adam's song is really sweet. So there you go, man. Take my punk card, I'm cashing it in, but I gotta stand by what I stand by, you know? That is it for this episode of the podcast. You can follow me on Twitter at David Callison. That's David and then K-A-L-L-I-S-O-N. Or email me at dcallison@mac.com. Next month, I have an interview with Deanna Bellos of Sincere Engineer talking all about her debut record, Rumbithian. Really excited for that. It's really good. A band called War on Women opened for Jawbreaker when I saw them in New York, and they're fantastic. I'm going to try to get Shauna on the podcast. If you are a band and you want me to check out your shit, please send it my way. I would love to. And I got laid off. So if you have a job for me, I'm really good at communication stuff. Let me know that too. I would love to have a little full-time employment action. Okay, go listen to War on Women. Go listen to Sincere Engineer. For sure, and go forth. And as always, stay alive. This one goes out to all our fans.
You make me smile!